and pledge online at WORTFM.org. You're tuned to WORT 89.9 FM Madison, listener-sponsored community radio and WORTFM.org.
Do you care about workers and labor issues? Do you want to make a difference in our community for working people? Then join the Labor Radio team. Labor Radio is a weekly show that covers labor, social justice, and political issues that impact workers. And we need your help. As a Labor Radio volunteer, you will have the opportunity to report on important labor and social justice stories in your community, interview workers, activists, and experts, produce and edit your own stories. No prior experience is necessary, though a connection with labor is a plus. We will provide training and support. All you need is a passion for worker justice and a desire to amplify the voices of working people. To learn more, contact Volunteer Coordinator Adrian Rainey at 608-321-9583 or head online to WORTFM.org/volunteer to fill out an application. Labor Radio, a voice for workers.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. President Trump has cited lowering levels of irregular border crossings as one of his administration's accomplishments. During a lengthy speech to Congress, Mr. Trump vowed further enforcement of immigration rules. He also used the speech to talk about major shifts in foreign policy and far-reaching federal government cuts. Namia Iqbal reports.
President Trump looks and sounds like he did the first time round, but now he's more experienced and emboldened. His speech really underlines the blitz of action he's taken since he returned to the White House. He's testing the boundaries of power and creating confusion, with Democrats, the opposition, unsure how to react. He can't run again, giving him 4 years to deliver on his big, bold promises.
The White House National Security Advisor Mike Waltz has said President Trump may restore American aid to Ukraine if peace talks with Russia are arranged. Speaking to Fox News, Mr. Waltz described President Zelensky's letter to his US counterpart, reaffirming his intention to negotiate, as a good, positive first step. He said confidence-building measures were already being discussed, but he didn't give specifics. Bangladesh says the UN has told it that the monthly food ration for Rohingya refugees will be cut by more than half from next month after it failed to find funds. Bangladesh is sheltering around 1 million Rohingya refugees who fled years of persecution and violence in Myanmar. Our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Ethirajan reports.
Mohammad Mizanur Rahman, the top Bangladeshi official overseeing the Rohingya refugee camps, said food rations per person from the World Food Programme would be reduced from around $12 to $6. Mr. Rahman said what the refugees had been receiving was already not enough, and it was hard to imagine the consequences of the new cut. A WFP official in Cox's Bazar told the BBC that they had failed to find donors so far, and if they could get enough money, they might avoid the cut.
The European Commissioner for Industrial Strategy has said EU carmakers are facing mortal danger. Stéphane Séjourné was speaking before launching a plan that aims to protect the sector.
We're going to protect this sector from unfair competition abroad. We already have measures in place for Chinese cars, and we'll also have to impose restrictions on components, and therefore on car components. Some of them must now be made in Europe. We're currently working on this list.
The bloc faces acute competition from China and the US in electric vehicle production. Mr. Séjourné insisted the EU was still in the battle. The Chinese premier has announced plans to try to revive the flagging economy by boosting spending and investment. Li Qiang said a growth target of 5% was still achievable if domestic demand became the main engine for growth. World News.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and TNW Ensemble Theatre, presenting Scammed, a new comedy running March 13th through March 23rd at TNW Ensemble Theatre, 1957 Winnebago Street. When a freelancing editor falls for a classic scam, she assumes the amoral alter ego of Helen Wheels to get even. Tickets are available at the door with cash or check, or online through Ticket Tailor. More information is available by calling 608-770-0826.
Support for this program comes from Edgewood College Theater, presenting Kimberly Bellflower's biting, funny new play, John Proctor is the Villain, directed by Jeannie Leap, February 28th to March 8th at the Diane Bullwig Theater. At a rural high school in Georgia, teens are studying the crucible while navigating love, sex, and school scandals. Holding a contemporary lens to the American classic, they question, who is really the hero and what is the truth? Discovering their own power in the process. Tickets at edgewood.edu/about/events/theater. Or search Edgewood College Theater.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, March 5th, and this is the 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Jan Miyasaki. This morning, I'll be speaking with Chris Mills Rodrigo of the Institute for Policy Studies, where he is the managing editor of inequality.org. Inequality.org has been tracking inequality-related news for two decades now. It's aimed to provide information, facts, insights to its readers. And answers the question, what can we do to narrow the staggering economic inequality that so inflicts us in almost every aspect of our lives? So stay tuned to hear from Chris Mills Rodrigo. And then later, an interview with Alice Rothschild. Alice Rothschild is the author of Inspired and Outraged, The Making of a Feminist Physician. She practiced OBGYN for almost 40 years, was taught at Harvard Medical School. Her work in activism has been honored in many places, including named Peace Pioneer by the American Jewish Peace Archive. She's active in Jewish Voice for Peace, and this is her sixth book, but her first written in verse. I interviewed her earlier, and we'll hear some of that interview this morning. I want to thank Lori and Tina, who are answering phones this morning for our pledge drive. And also thank you, Doug, for breakfast. And good morning, and thank you, Norman Stockwell, publisher of the Progressive Magazine, for joining me. The pledge drive, a celebration of community radio, is the theme. A celebration of ultimately then our community itself, right, Norm?
That's right, absolutely. This program really is a celebration of community, Jan, the way that you bring in all sorts of different folks together here to sit around the table and have a conversation. And that's something that, you know, you don't hear that on a lot of the mainstream media where there's people shouting at each other or people shouting over each other. But here at WRT, it's a civil conversation between people talking about opinions, talking about issues, and bringing you news and information about the world around you, news that you can use. 608-256-2001 is the number to call. You can pledge your support right now to keep WORT Community Radio on the air. 50 years here in Madison, Wisconsin this year, celebrating the 50th anniversary, and only because of your generous support. Lots of thank you gifts to offer at lots of various different levels, but really the thank you is getting this radio in your ears 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
Now, we have a new WORT T-shirt, so make sure to ask our phone answerers about that. Features a 45-year design back from 1980 by Dan Slick, and that's a long-sleeve T-shirt. It's beautiful.
Local Madison artist, longtime member of the Survival Graphics Collective over on Williamson Street.
That was the go-to place, wasn't
that's right.
It?
And you still see Dan Slick at all the outdoor festivals, sitting there doing paintings of the festival scenes in Madison summertime.
Now, I believe it is still the case that new donors will have their donation doubled. So, hey, now's the time to call. If you haven't, if you've donated in the past and it has lapsed, so maybe in the last 2 years or more you haven't made a pledge, please call us this morning and make your pledge to support WORT. Also, one of the pledge gifts, if you call in this morning, is a Progressive Magazine subscription. And Norman and I were talking off there about, you know, how much we need to have the right, the places to go to for the news and viewpoints that are fact-based and are truthful.
That's right, especially right now, you know, as the current administration is attacking media, is taking away access from media, the AP News Service, a more than 150-year-old news bureau, losing its access to the White House. And in fact, the Trump administration has now taken control over who gets access. It's no longer the independent White House Correspondents Association that selects people to be at these press conferences and on these planes and so on. It's the Trump administration. And as the head of the White House Correspondents Association said in his press release on this, in a democracy, presidents don't get to choose their press. 608-256-2001. If you want to choose your press here by supporting WORT Community Radio, your source for news, information, and cultural programming here in Madison, Wisconsin. And thanks to the internet around the globe on an app or on your laptop or your tablet and on your phone, any way you want to listen to it. And in fact, we determined a couple of pledge drives ago that you can actually listen to WORT on the space station.
Well, there you go. Hey, Dave, let's just hear just a few seconds of music. I know Chris Mills, Rodrigo standing by, but we can catch our breath.
Yeah, but before that, we've got an online pledge already, Jan.
Oh, thank you.
It's Anonymous from Madison. And
well,
Anonymous
great.
Has made a very generous pledge. Thank you, Anonymous. And it says, Dan and I appreciate the wide range of programs, music, interviews, and news. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And that's another way you can pledge. You can go online to WORTFM.org. Click the donate button. It's quick. It's easy. And it gives you a chance to support us without even having to call.
Minutes after 8, and thank you for standing by. Chris Mills Rodrigo is with the Institute for Policy Studies, where he's the managing editor of inequality.org. I've been tracking inequality-related news and viewpoints for nearly 2 decades now. It's aimed to provide information and insight to its readers, focusing on what can we do to narrow the staggering economic inequality that so afflicts us in almost every aspect of our lives. Hey, good morning, Chris. You know, good morning, are you there?
Yes, good
Hi,
morning.
Chris. So, Chris, you know, I haven't really digested what happened last night. I'll let listeners know I read it. I read the transcript. I didn't watch it. I know others who have. Maybe I'll just start there. I am so grateful for inequality.org. Let me just start there because we definitely need facts. We need the truth. Your takeaways.
Yeah, I mean, I think a totally reasonable decision not to tune in. It ended up being one of the longest joint addresses, I think, in American history at 99 minutes long. And as you sort of alluded to there with facts, it was chock full of, I mean, I don't even know if misinformation is the right term, just sort of completely fabricated
yes.
ideas of what the administration has been accomplishing so far. This was sort of part a celebration, in quotes, of what the administration has done so far, and then also a bit of table setting for what the next year is going to look like from the Trump administration.
Keep going.
Yeah.
Keep going.
Yeah, yeah.
No,
yes,
go ahead.
Some of the biggest takeaways, one, I think, was just how much of a focus the Department of Government Efficiency was during Trump's speech. He really touted the work that the Elon Musk-led agency has done so far, making some pretty outlandish claims about fraud in the Social Security system, which there's no evidence of, and kind of listing a laundry list of programs that sort of maybe on first listen might sound like wasteful government spending, but as soon as you look into them at all, they're, you know, pretty critical to saving a lot of lives, both here and abroad. I think it was pretty telling that he sort of just made claims about the savings that Doge has been, accumulating so far without kind of acknowledging the reality that using their own website, if you go through the contracts they've actually terminated, 40% of them have no savings. I think the broader point with this whole assault on the federal bureaucracy and this idea of cost cutting is that the government's not a corporation. The government's goal is not to run as a for-profit institution. The goal of the government is to provide services for the people that pay into it with taxes. And when you see agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency, when you see the Department of Veteran Affairs, when you see these places that are being totally hollowed out, staff that have been there 20, 30 years being let go, that provide critical services for their community, nothing about it really screams saving costs to me. It screams like hollowing out the government and creating a situation where private enterprise can fill in the gaps.
And there really isn't any sizable savings that they can really point to as a result of this. So what do you think this is, ultimately about?
Well, I think it's pretty telling that before the beginning of Trump's administration, there were 11 government agencies that were investigating companies or Elon Musk himself, companies run by Elon Musk or Elon Musk himself, and all 11 of those agencies have seen their staff and their power significantly weakened. I think that is a pretty, clear one-to-one. Elon Musk feels threatened by these agencies, decides to cut them. I think when you look at something like illegally firing one of the members of the National Labor Relations Board, it seems that the goal there is pretty clear. It's to hamstring the ability of the labor movement to grow. Right now, I know a lot of unions are choosing not even to file cases when workers are being, mistreated or not paid, because they know that it'll just go to the NLRB, which doesn't have quorum. And a lot of it is just kind of continuing the same strategy that Republicans have had for a long time. They know that in the minds of Americans, they are the small government party. They're the anti-government party. If all they do when they're in power is hollow out and weaken the government, then the case for not investing in the government becomes stronger and stronger, because it really doesn't work. It doesn't work as well when there are, 9,000 less IRS agents. There's a lot more tax fraud in that case. So it's a lot easier to say, look, the government does nothing, vote for us, and we'll keep cutting costs.
Now, what are you hearing about the impact of the loss of jobs because of these cuts? What are you hearing about any kind of organizing?
That's a great question. Federal workers, a lot of them are in unions, a lot of them aren't in unions, but many of them have come together in the last couple weeks to try to organize to save their jobs or to oppose the cuts that are being done. The Federal Unionist Network has been putting on a series of protests across the country featuring federal workers who have been, pointing out the essential tasks that they do. I think it's been really appreciated to see the workers themselves coming out and saying, look, like, we make significantly less money than people do in the private sector. And 80% of us aren't based in D.C. We're all over the country. We're all over the country making normal amounts of money, providing key services for our communities. And I think just like laying out very clear that there's a human impact to these cuts.
People have their differences, but this is going to take people setting some of those aside and pulling in one direction together. We've talked about that in the past, that you saw that in parts of Europe bucking against this right-wing trend. Are we hearing that kind of organizing going on?
I think it's an interesting one. The Democratic response last night to me felt somewhat disjointed. You had people that chose to just boycott the speech. You had people that tried to disrupt the speech, like Representative Al Green, who was then escorted out of the building. I think it's the first time that's happened in a long time at one of these addresses. But then you had these sort of disjointed, some people wore different color clothing. Some people like put up signs. It doesn't seem like Democrats are on the same page as of now on how to be an effective opposition party. Beyond that, though, I think there has been some really encouraging organizing, especially from unions, from tenant organizations that have been sort of taking the fight directly to the government on these issues. I think you can see some of the activism that's been done just outside of federal government buildings, but then also kind of behind the scenes trying to protect worker jobs with a series of legal challenges to what DOGE has been doing. Providing support for people who are being affected by cuts to the federal government.
On some level, the messaging to me is pretty straightforward. And you're saying that the narrative in the president's speech was the party is small government, anti-waste, whatnot, that we know so much behind that. It's about self-dealing, taxes for the rich, tax cuts for the billionaires. So the message really is about protecting the wealthiest and really making that message clear, because it can be made confusing about what the truth is about how much taxes billionaires pay. So I think, or to take that somehow as unpatriotic when it is, to me, very patriotic. So, the message can be very clear, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we've also seen some coherence, in the fight against the extension of the 2017 Trump tax cuts, where people are, making a pretty compelling case that this is just a boon for the billionaires and an assault on the middle class and the working class in America, that there are going to be these huge extensions of tax cuts. And when you pair that with, having the size of the IRS, what you're doing is permitting rich people to keep on avoiding even the paltry taxes that they have to pay now. So I do agree that the messaging should be pretty straightforward. We don't want to bail out billionaires. We don't want to organize our society in a way where the very rich get to accumulate more and more resources. And we want to use the government to rectify some of the inequalities that are out there now. And, that means a positive vision of a government that helps to improve conditions for all of its citizens, whether that be with worker protections, whether that be with more aggressive environmental protections. I think that that's a very consistent and I think persuasive message for people. I think it's worth remembering that a lot of people that ended up voting for Trump in exit polls said that the main reason they voted for me is because they thought that he had a more coherent plan for reducing the cost of living. And I think that that's a arena where an opposition party cannot be letting Republicans dictate the terms, because the Republicans don't really have a plan for reducing the cost of living. They do for their friends, their millionaire, billionaire friends. But the policies we've seen so far, like the tariffs on Canada and Mexico, are only going to make the situation with cost of living here in America worse.
And, it's tax breaks for the billionaires. It's the culture wars and that are just ugly. Have you been keeping your ear to the ground on how people outside the U.S. are reading this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been a strange time for allies of the United States internationally. I think especially with J.D. Vance's recent speech in Europe, where he basically excoriated center-left and center-right parties for not allowing free speech in Europe, which is a very strange kind of, I guess, dig at any policies that like restrict hate speech, basically. There was the kind of strange broadcast argument between Trump, J.D. Vance, and the Ukrainian president Zelensky last week, where Trump basically says, you have to thank us and have to, be very appreciative of the U.S. or else we're going to cut our aid. And you see it in the case of like a close American ally like Justin Trudeau in Canada, where, the whole situation has shifted with these tariffs. We're now, I don't know if this is the correct term, but essentially a trade war now. with two of our geographically closest allies in Canada and Mexico. So I think the situation abroad is one of confusion, but also I think just a confirmation that the unipolar world led by America, it's not there anymore. There are other powers out there that are exerting similar, if not more, influence, and that are just more trusted than the United States, I think understandably so.
That's right. The whole, from what I read, the Greenland and the Panama Canal business was in there too. So Chris Mills Rodrigo, you're the managing editor at inequality.org. You are on a team with some folks at it for a really long time, this kind of organizing. Can you talk about speaking to people today? Because this is going to take a big effort. It feels, I would say my personal opinion is that this is not going to implode under the weight of itself. Some kind of organizing has to happen. How is this, you know, in terms of framing it to the range of readers at inequality.org, younger and older alike?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's difficult. I think, you know, we have to be aware that people have different capacities to, you know, contribute. People have different, you know, risk in getting involved in organizing, which I think is, you know, something that we should be aware of. And there are people who have been, you know, in this fight for a very long time and, you know, deserve a break every so often. So I think, you know, not saying that there's one size fits all solution for how you should get involved, but I think, you know, anything that you can do to support, for example, federal workers and immigrant workers, who I think are both canaries in the coal mine for the kind of assault on labor that we're going to see over the next 4 years. I think finding ways that you can support local organizing at the city and state level, where we are seeing some, not just quote unquote resistance to Trump, but also some, you know, truly progressive policies. You know, we're seeing candidates running for local office that are running on progressive platforms of reducing the cost of living. So I think any way that you can get involved, you know, in those campaigns is great. Any way that you can just help your community, help those in your community that are being affected the most by this, you know, mutual aid networks, everything helps. And I guess I don't want to say like that there's one thing that everyone should be doing.
You know, is it, can technology really facilitate this, or is it old, good old face-to-face? What's your take on that? Because I'm not so good with the online organizing.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in face-to-face organizing as well. I think, you know, the more people that you can talk to directly in your community, hear from them, hear what they need, and work together, I think the better. I think a lot of online organizing, you know, I don't want to pile on anyone, but this, I don't know if maybe you or your listeners saw this one-day economic boycott that was spreading on social media last week. That kind of thing, a boycott with a set end date and no specific goals and no organization behind it, that's not going to get us anywhere. What's going to get us places is consistent, dedicated organizing in our communities with long-term visions of how we want our society to be organized.
You know, the last couple of weeks I've been on PBS, we've been playing, in February, they were playing pieces of Eyes on the Prize, and it was just continues to be such a good piece of documentary work. You know, are you concerned about freedom of speech rights for those who don't agree with the administration? I think people might end up going to jail. Might have to.
I would say, speaking from my personal position, not on a position at the Institute of Policy Studies, I am extremely worried about what we're seeing on campuses.
Yes.
I think these threats to pull federal funding from institutions where there are, you know, I'm going to use the administration's language here, obviously, I don't agree with it, but, you know, people supporting terrorism, I think that we were already seeing pretty aggressive anti-free speech policies on campuses against people protesting for Palestine. And that being ramped up, I think, should be causing us all concern.
Yes. Hey, Chris, we could talk longer. I have to say so long for now, but we will be in touch frequently this spring. Chris Mills Rodrigo is the managing editor at inequality.org, a project of the Institute for Policy Studies. Read anything at the inequality.org website, then click onto the newsletter, get the weekly newsletter. It's all really great context. This is the context we need right now. I think it's one of the important contexts of a trio, perhaps. thank you, Chris Mills Rodrigo, for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
And it is 8:30. Hi, Chris. Hey, and hi, Norm. Thank you, those of you who've been pledging.
Yes, we want to thank Rose, who called in a nice pledge and picked up on the teal colored crossbody bag, one of a whole bunch of great clothing accessories. Here we have the crossbody bags, we have the knit winter hats, we have umbrellas, t-shirts, and then a great tan backpack. So all of those available at different pledge levels. You can talk to the phone answerer at 608-256-2001, and you can pick out one of those thank you gifts, or you can go on the web at wortfm.org. Rose says she likes the 8 o'clock buzz, all the news and music. And that's really, you know, what WORT is. It's a mixture of news and music programming. We have shows like the 8 o'clock buzz in the morning. We have wonderful music programs before and after that, and we have news in the middle of the day, more music in the afternoon, news in the evening. So it's a great a selection of all the different things. It's like going to a smorgasbord dinner and picking the different things off your plate that you like. WRT brings you a smorgasbord of news, information, and culture here on the radio at 89.9 FM and on the internet at WORTFM.org. Jen, we really need to push the fact that there's a very special challenge going on right now. For every new donor who donates to this show, WORT will receive double their donation. And for every lapsed donor who donates to this show, WORT will receive double their donation. Lapsed donor is somebody who's been gone for like 18 months or something. But if you fit in one of those categories, and if you pledge right now, Jan's program will get credited with double your donation, which is great for this show. It's great for the station, and it's great for you because it means that your dollars are going farther to keep this treasure on the air here in Madison, Wisconsin.
The other way that can just really be helpful with our budgeting process is those of you who can do the evergreen monthly donation. And so call and ask the phone answers how to do that, and you'll get sent the paperwork. So nothing's going to be taken over
small,
the phone.
Yeah, a small amount of money that gets taken out of your bank account. It's easy for you, and it's great for us here at the station because it means that we have a guaranteed flow of income month after month. It's not just when we come on the air a couple of times a year and ask for it, but it's throughout the whole calendar year. 608-256-2001. You can talk to Lori or Tina out there, and they'll have more information on the Evergreen donors, and that sustains us here at WORT.
Hey, so now before we get to our next interview, in the freedom of speech, and freedom of speech for those who speak truth to power, people who contest the billionaires. We've been through that before.
We have. I mean, most prominent, perhaps in memory, is the Red Scare and the Lavender Scares of the late 1940s and on into the 50s and even the 60s. The House Un-American Activities Committee was going until 1968. So these kind of threats to freedom of speech, I think, are very important and very much a part of the history that we need to be looking at as we look at what's happening right now, especially on college campuses where there's a lot of challenges, repression of freedom of speech as students have been protesting, and also faculty, and particularly contingent faculty, the part-timers and the LTEs and so on, concerned about their future as administrations crack down. And the Trump administration is pushing this as much as anybody, but it's really a great concern about the freedom of speech of people to speak out against their government here in the United States.
It's 835, the number is 608-256-2001 or WORTFM.org, and press the donation button. I want to get started. I had a while ago done an interview with Alice Rothschild, author of Inspired and Outraged, The Making of a Feminist Physician. She practiced OBGYN for almost 40 years, was a professor at Harvard Medical School. Her work and activism honored in many places, including named Peace Pioneer by the American Jewish Peace Archive. She's an active in Jewish Voice for Peace, their health advisory council. This is her sixth book, but the first written in verse. Let's start hearing that. We're going to hear about 14 minutes, and then we'll be back. Why did you write this book, and why in free verse?
Well, Jen, it's wonderful to be on your show. I was had a friend who 20 years ago said I should write a memoir, and I basically blew her off, but it started percolating in my brain. And as I watched the turn of events in our country with the loss of more and more reproductive choice and Roe v. Wade and the rightward swing against a lot of gains that women had thought we took for granted, I felt more compelled to write a story that reminds people of what it was like before in the 50s and what the struggles were and what the 60s were like when we had a sense that we could change the course of U.S. history fighting against the Vietnam War. And I think this is important history. It's also important women's history, feminist history. And so I thought trying to share my story would be a valuable resource. And it's also a call to action, because I think a lot of us are feeling pretty blindsided. And it's important to remember that many of the victories that we thought we were had forever, you will lose them unless you keep struggling for them. So this book is also an urging people not to be complacent and to continue in the struggle. I hadn't planned to write it in verse. I've always written poetry, but I had poems published, but never thought of myself as a poet. This is my sixth book and my first book of poetry. And I first tried writing it in prose, and it just didn't sing to me. And then the memories started coming to me in verse, and I would just write down a line, an idea. And it would come to me, in the middle of the night, I'd have to get up and write, or hiking or biking, all sorts of places where my brain was off thinking without my control. And so these poems just kept coming, and then I would work on them and play with them and, throw some out and keep some, and that kind of process. And at the end of this whole thing, I had this huge pile of poems in no particular order. And then I had to figure out how to wrestle it into a story, and what was the story that emerged from this. And that's how the book developed.
Wow.
The graduation poem.
Yeah.
136. So I went to Bryn Mawr College, which is it's one of the Seven Sisters. It was my first experience of class and the impact of, being in this very white, almost Southern feeling school with Black help waiting on us and, girls who were daughters of ambassadors and, went to Europe on summer vacations. It was a whole different kind of people than I was used to. And then I graduated. I had been pre-med and I had a major in psychology. And when I graduated in 1970, I wanted people to understand what we were graduating into. So I can just read the facts. This is part of a poem about graduation. The facts. In 1970, banks could require a woman applying for credit have her husband co-sign. In 1970, employers could legally fire a woman for being pregnant. In 1970, conjugal rights meant that it was legal for a man to rape his wife. U.S. laws included housing discrimination, pay discrimination, jury exclusion for women. A husband had unilateral control of property jointly owned. A woman had half the legal rights of a man, earned 59 cents to the dollar. Help wanted ads in newspapers, listed jobs separately for men, just about everything for women, secretarial, nursing, teaching in 1970.
Yes. And reading from the, I think it's the American Psychiatry about women. I thought
So what that is about is when I was 6 years old, I announced to my parents I was going to be a psychiatrist. I have absolutely no idea why. I didn't maybe even know what it was, but I like the word. I have no idea. But, you know, I was like one of these sort of laser beam kind of kids. So, you know, that was what I was going to do. I was going to be a doctor. I was going to be a psychiatrist. And I, you know, wrote a paper on schizophrenia in ninth grade. I worked at the mental institution when I was a senior in high school. I majored in psychology. I mean, I was just straight arrow. And then I got to medical school. And unfortunately for me, the psychiatry department was very, very Freudian. And so, for instance, early on in my first year of medical school, a psychiatrist pointed out the very few women in the class because I was there before the wave. And he said, you are all here because of your unresolved penis envy. And, you know, that's a pretty heavy thing to say to women. And so I, you know, I really had this midlife crisis in medical school about what to be. And then I thought, you know, it couldn't have been that bad. So I actually ordered my old psychiatry text because on, you know, these used book sites, you can find these books. And it was even worse than I had imagined. So I wrote a poem that incorporates pieces of the textbook in the poem. And it's just, it's an appallingly rigidly Freudian view of women that, you know, I think psychiatry has hopefully moved way beyond that. And there are certainly many psychiatrists that are very, you know, progressive and feminist and all that kind of thing. But for instance, here's a phrase about pregnancy. If the mother has come to terms with being a woman, which includes some lingering regrets at not having been born a boy, she feels that her pregnancy is fulfilling her fate, completing her life as a woman, and she knows a creativity that compensates for past restrictions and limitations. Now, this is a textbook written by the head of psychiatry at Yale University, and this is the kind of stuff he's writing about women. So you can imagine if doctors are trained with that textbook, how they view women, which isn't particularly helpful for us. So I really wanted to document where we were coming from and what kind of struggles we had. You know, for instance, the head of my obstetrics department, who was just an enormously, profoundly sexist man, opened the section on obstetrics with a lecture he used to give called What is a Woman? And it was a woman is a man's mother, a man's mistress, a man's competitor. I mean, it was appalling. I mean, we actually had protests in front of his lectures. But we were the first year to say, you know, this is really not okay. And people would look at us like, you know, what's wrong with you? Can't, you know, it just, we were like coming from Mars. Or when we, in microbiology, we would be, the slides would be projected on a drop-down screen. And interspersed with the microbiology slides were pictures of Playboy bunnies half naked. And everybody thought that was funny. And we were like, no, this is not funny, you know. And we went to the dean and said, this is demeaning and inappropriate. And he was like, you know, can't you take a joke? It's funny. And it was like, no, it's not funny. And so we were like, you know, calling people out on the basic beginning, you know, how to treat a woman with sensitivity and decency, because it just wasn't happening as sort of the very chauvinistic attitudes that existed in medicine, because medicine was a man's world and, you know, somewhat continues to be, although it's changed dramatically, but, you know, not enough. But we were really on the ground floor of calling it out, and there was a huge amount to call out.
You know, and you have to cry for all the women who were receiving health care.
Sure.
Before
absolutely.
Times.
And, you know, there are women that still receive health care that just makes you want to cringe. And I think we have a lot of work to do. We can't sit back and say, well, we fixed that, because we haven't fixed that. We've made it a lot better. And having more women in the field has been very helpful, although it's not a guarantee. You know, women can be as oppressive as men, but usually they aren't. And we also have a much broader view of women's health care. I mean, when I was in medical school and residency, I learned nothing about menstrual cramps, premenstrual syndrome, perimenopause, menopause, vulvar pain, you know, pain with intercourse. These were things that were, you know, these are women's issues that not very interesting. No one studied them. No one talked about them. And now there are, you know, there's the North American Menopause Society and there's the Society for Family Planning. And, you know, it's the field has changed a lot, but, you know, it's still, we have work to do.
So you decide to not become a psychiatrist, you choose OBGYN. Can you talk about, you know, you formed the first all women's practice? There was no other way, right? That was the only way to go.
So first of all, you know, usually the older male docs would offer jobs to the younger residents coming up. But no one offered, there were two women my year, me and my best friend. And, you know, no one wanted us in their practice. And it was before a woman in your practice was considered a good thing. And I think they thought we were too much trouble. They thought we were threatening. They wouldn't even cover maternity leaves for our practice. So we decided to open our own practice.
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
You know, at the beginning, every patient received a copy of Our Bodies, Ourselves. I mean, we were going to do it our way. And the problem with our way was that even though we were set up as a not-for-profit with a community board, we were not business people, and medicine exists in business, you know. And so if you have, you know, long visits and you spend hours helping women in labor and you do the things that I think are important, it's not cost-effective. And so we had this deal that we would close the practice when our malpractice insurance costs more than our salaries, and that took the night.
Now, you gave your patients copies of our bodies, ourselves. Can you talk about, because you were a contributor from the beginning and then subsequent editions.
Right. So Our Bodies, Ourselves is a book that has been described as the Bible of the feminist movement. And it came out of a collective of women who were looking at how healthcare was being practiced and how women's healthcare was being practiced and felt like women weren't being treated as, you know, human beings and as equals to men. And so they met and talked and put together a book that was basically describing to women what their body is, how it works, naming all the parts, what different illnesses are, what the options are, and also putting it in a political context. Because, you know, people say, oh, don't get too political in medicine. Well, medicine is totally.
That segment ends with medicine is totally political. You're listening to an interview with Alice Rothschild. The book is chock full of great stories and footnotes, inspired and outraged the making of a feminist physician. We're going to hear the last 4 minutes in a little bit, but just wanted to pause here and say that to join our celebration of community radio.
Absolutely. And we have a couple of people to thank. We want to thank Anonymous, who longtime supporter of WRT, who made a pledge this morning. And the question on the form is, what are your three favorite shows? And they say all. So there we go. And then we also want to thank Peggy, who just called in with a generous pledge and says, Jan, you're the best all the way. Aloha. 608-256-2001. You can talk to Lori or Tina out there, and they will take your pledges over the phone, or you can go online to WORTFM.org, as Anonymous did earlier this in the show, and we need you to go there as well. Support this community radio station, because it's really the only place that you'll get this kind of news information, this access to the newsmakers, interviews like the one that you're listening to right now that Jan did with Alice Rothschild, that, you know, Jan doesn't just come in here and do her show on Wednesday morning. She works all week long to put this program together. She calls people. She keeps an eye on the news. She figures out what are the important topics that you, the listeners, need to hear about. And then sometimes she'll do a pre-recorded interview. Sometimes she'll do a live phone call. Sometimes she'll have somebody in here in the studio as a guest. But all of it with an eye to you, the listener out there, bringing you the news and information that you need to hear, news about issues that affect your life. And that's what community radio is all about, 608-256-2001. And by the way, again, just emphasizing that every new donor who donates to this show and every lapsed donor who hasn't pledged in 18 months or so will automatically be doubled. So if you call in a pledge right now, if you're a brand new donor, they'll be worth twice as much to WORT, and it's a great benefit, and we really appreciate it from that longtime generous donor who's made this challenge.
We're going to hear the last about 4 minutes of that interview with Alice Rothschild, and we'll be back. So the number is 256-608-256-2001. WORTFM.org, and that's all the way. So thanks, Peg, and to all of those who've been calling in. We'll catch up now with Alice Rothschild.
Political. And so this was a revolutionary book, and I was involved in it as a medical student and as a practicing doctor for years.
You know, the you tell a story happens in 1993 called the Pap smear, and I appreciated that story. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So when I was early in my practice, the big struggle was to get decent health care for gays and lesbians, but we hadn't had experience with people who were non-binary, who didn't fit into the categories that society had created. So that Pap smear poem is about my first meeting with a transgendered man who comes in for a Pap smear, and reflecting on, I wanted to create a safe space for him and a situation where he would feel welcome. And as I thought about it, I looked around, he's sitting in a room full of pregnant women and menopausal women and women coming for birth control pills. The magazines are all very heterosexual, female oriented, and it must have been really, really hard for him. And when he got up, people stared at him, and it was part of my understanding of what we could do better. I think once the door closed, he felt he had a decent experience, but we could have done better, but we were just learning how to take care of people who were non-binary. And so that was just, I think, very important to put in the book, and has become much more central issue in medicine as the months and years have gone by.
There's so much to talk about, but folks are going to have to find out themselves. But you tell the story in six parts. Part 1-5 is your history. Part 6, something you call the unadulterated, unapologetic herstory. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So I'm very interested in exploring the history of medicine through the lens of race and sex. And so because I'd been so involved in psychiatry and wanted to be a psychiatrist and then didn't want to be a psychiatrist, I wanted to explore the history of psychiatry looking at it through the lens of racism. And so what I did was I created a conversation between this theoretical psychiatrist and this theoretical patient, going through the history starting in the 1700s of how psychiatry formed, what the attitudes were. I mean, it was a profoundly racist endeavor. There was a psychiatrist that thought that, blackness was something that could be scrubbed off your skin. And I mean, just really crazy stuff. So I wanted to, in a sort of serious and somewhat snarky way, to just go through this and say, look, this is where they're coming from. And so, people are somewhat reflective of the history of where their specialty comes from. And so it's important to have that up front. And then I wanted to do what I called an unauthorized outrage feminist history of childbirth and doctoring in America, totally biased because I think women in general are smart, strong, and by the way, have been having babies since just after Adam and Eve bit the apple and Mr. Snake wiggled out of the garden. because the history of OBGYN is incredibly political. And doctors, you know, considered women healers in the way back in the 1300s. They were witches and, you know, dangerous, crazy women. And then, you know, women midwives provided care for women. That was basically the medical care you got. And doctors took over midwifery before they had any science. So they ran women who were midwives out of the field, claiming, you know, they knew best and, you know, they had leeches and enemas and all the crazy things they did. Way before there was an understanding of the germ theory, washing your hands, all that kind of stuff. So I thought it was really important to share that history. And, you know, so like a lot of people are unaware that one of the big, quote, fathers of obstetrics and gynecology is James Marion Sims. And he developed some very important surgical techniques for injuries that occur during childbirth, where a woman develops an opening either between her vagina and her rectum or her vagina and her bladder and then leaks. You know, it's a horrible situation with prolonged labors. But he was a slave owner, and he did all his experimenting on women slaves without anesthesia. And I think we need to remember that. You know, it's just recently that, you know, the statues of him in every major university are being taken down, and there are statues now to the slave women that he practiced on. I mean, he did tens of surgical procedures on a whole bunch of women slaves. And to think of doing that without anesthesia, and they were held down screaming, it's just like, oh my goodness. And to think that that was okay. And then once he perfected the technique, he did it on white women with anesthesia. So I think that's important history.
And that is an interview with Alice Rothschild, author of Inspired and Outraged, The Making of a Feminist Physician. That was a difficult story to hear at the end. The book is really interesting, written in free verse, but lots of history in it that needs to be told. It's 8:56, and we just want to turn back to our fundraiser. Thank you so much to our pledges this morning. We've been hearing a lot. I feel like I need to find the bell, but anyhow.
Well, we just got another web pledge. We want to thank Trish, who pledged.
Oh, there we go.
There's the bell. Trish, who pledged on the web and picked up on the wart patch. We haven't mentioned the patch, but it's a wonderful cloth patch that you can sew on your backpack or your hat or your jacket. And Trish likes 8 o'clock Buzz on Wednesday, likes all the jazz shows, and likes Letters and Politics, which comes on Mondays at 1 o'clock. So great variety of WORT themed programs there. 608-256-2001 or WORTFM.org on the web. And again, during this program, if you are a new donor who has never pledged before, or if you're a donor who hasn't pledged in a year and a half or so, we will get double your money if you pledge right now in these last couple of minutes of the Wednesday 8 o'clock Buzz. This is your last chance to support the Wednesday 8 o'clock Buzz during this pledge drive. So please go to your phones or go to your computers right now and pledge your support to WORTFM.org.
Yeah, enjoy the match that's available to new and lapsed donors. And also consider the Evergreen monthly donation process, which is also really a way to spread what you can donate over the 12 months of the year. And circling back to the Progressive magazine, and that is available. It's a real deal, actually.
Yeah, lots of great thank you gifts. The Progressive magazine is something that comes to you every other month in the mail. It's a physical magazine, and 116 years old this year, and based here in Madison, Wisconsin. So you can get that at the $40 pledge level, a one-year subscription to the Progressive. We've got the patch that we just mentioned. We've got bumper stickers. We've got the crossbody bag, the knit hat, the headphones. That's another one. It's a pair of headphones themed around Bob Marley, and you can get that limited quantity available online if you pledge at WORTFM.org. We've got this El Dorado backpack, a brand new tan-colored backpack, first ever for this type of premium. The wonderful T-shirt with the Dan Slick design on it. It's a great historic and modern T-shirt. 608-256-2001. The phone answerers out there, Lori and Tina, can talk you through all of the different choices that you can make here for thank you gifts. But really, the thank you gift is this program and all of the programs here on WORT, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year for 50 years here in Madison.
Thank you. Thank you for all of you who have been donating during this pledge drive. Thank you to those during this hour. This community, live and virtual, and, you know, an antidote, I hope, in these times to what is out there. Thank you to Tina and Lori, Doug, for breakfast. Thank you, Dave Lawrenson, our music producer and engineer. Thank you for tuning in this morning. I'm Jan Miyasaki, and I'll talk with you next week.
And it's 9 o'clock. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison, your listener-sponsored community radio station. Stay tuned. Coming up next, the Insurgent Radio Kiosk. And then back to the country. Stay tuned.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Wednesday, March 5th.
The Trump-Musk administration thought they could just stomp on us and our Constitution, replacing democracy with a MAGA monarchy. But they had not reckoned with one fearsome opponent, Senator Chuck Schumer. The Senate's top Democrat says he's getting furious about the GOP's oligarchic coup attempt. Wow, he might even fire off one of his strongly worded letters to the White House. So far, though, the Democratic leader is meekly urging a horrified public to just weather the storm, predicting that, quote, Trump will screw up. Hello, Chuck. History clearly teaches that to fight totalitarianism, you actually have to fight. People are asking, why the hell is the party's top leadership AWOL? The good news is that grassroots people themselves, the little d Democrats, have taken to the streets leading the charge to stop this plutocratic, autocratic power grab. So leaders ought to at least follow. All Democratic national officials, including former Presidents Clinton, Obama, and Biden, should literally come out and stand together, demonstrating solidarity with a majority of Americans fighting this far-right, un-American assault by rampaging billionaires. Most encouraging is the fact